This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When the U.S. Supreme Court ruled last year that same-sex couples have the right to marry, Jim Obergefell's long journey was finally over. But when the ruling came down, an important part of Jim's life was missing: his husband, John Arthur. In 2013, John was suffering from ALS and wanted to die a married man. Jim and John had been partners for 20 years. They decided to marry each other in Maryland. But their home state of Ohio did not recognize their marriage, and that meant Jim would not be listed as a spouse on John's death certificate. Jim challenged the law all the way to the Supreme Court. It ultimately became a landmark decision for LGBT rights. A new book chronicles Jim and John's story. It is called Love Wins: The Lovers and Lawyers Who Fought the Landmark Case for Marriage Equality. Jim is co-author of the book and speaks Friday at the Cat's Cradle. Jim Obergefell, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks. Thrilled to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about your story and how it came to be all the way to the Supreme Court. It starts with the day that you proposed to John. Tell us about that.
Right. So on June 26, 2013, we were watching the news waiting for an update on the Windsor case from the Supreme Court. And when the Supreme Court released their ruling striking down part of the Defense of Marriage Act, I spontaneously asked John to marry me. And luckily, he said yes. But as you mentioned, he was dying of ALS and he was bedridden. So we had to figure out how to take a dying man to another state just to get married.
You decided on Maryland. It was somewhat closer than Massachusetts, where you also could have gone. But even that proved difficult. Tell us about the effort to get him there and the response that you had on social media.
Right. So we decided to go to Maryland because it was the one state that did not require both people to appear in person to apply for a marriage license. So that made things easier on us, especially John. So I started researching how we could get there, and I ruled out an ambulance. It would just be too painful for him to take that long of a trip, and he couldn't fly commercially. So I started looking into chartered medical jets, and they're pretty darn expensive. And it was something that we could handle, but I went to Facebook thinking maybe our family or friends might have a contact. So I just posted asking if anyone knew a pilot or knew someone who worked for a chartered jet company. And our family and friends immediately responded saying, "Sorry, Jim, we can't help you with that. But you and John deserve to get married, and we want to help make it happen." And they banded together, and through their generosity, they covered the entire $13,000 cost of that jet.
What was that like for you? I mean, were you expecting that kind of response?
Not at all. It wasn't something that I would have ever imagined happening. And in fact, people started suggesting, you know, "Jim, start a GoFundMe page or something like that." And I wasn't comfortable doing that. People kept saying, "We want to help, we want to help, we want to help." So when people offered, I just had to accept the fact that they really sincerely wanted to do that. So we accepted their gift, and it was an amazing experience to know that our family and friends saw us as married and wanted us to get married as much as we wanted to.
So you got married then in Maryland, came back to Ohio. You knew your home state was not going to recognize your marriage. Initially, what was that like? How did that weigh on you, the fact that your home state didn't recognize it, but in fact you were married, at least in the eyes of the state of Maryland?
Right. So we knew Ohio wouldn't recognize it because of their state mini-DOMA, but that was really kind of an abstract concept. You don't really understand what that means until you're put in a situation where it suddenly becomes real. And for us, it was the fact that the federal government would acknowledge us for purposes of tax returns, federal-level benefits, those types of things. And all we wanted was to be recognized by our government. One level of government was all we wanted. And the weekend after we got married, our story was in the newspaper, and friends ran into a friend of theirs who is a local civil rights attorney, Al Gerhardstein. And our story came up in conversation, and Al asked them if they thought we might be willing to talk. So they got in touch, John and I discussed it, and Al came over to meet us 5 days after we got married.
Why did he want to talk to you? Again, you know, and to some extent it's over for you. At least now you've been recognized in some state. The marriage is recognized. What was it that Al had to say that caused you to want to talk with him a little more?
Well, what he did during our conversation was pull out a blank Ohio death certificate. And he said, "Now, guys, I'm sure you haven't thought about this, because who would think about a death certificate when you've just gotten married? But do you understand that when John dies, his last official record as a person will be wrong? Ohio will say he's unmarried, and Jim, your name won't be there as his surviving spouse. That was the moment that abstract knowledge, that abstract concept of that state constitutional amendment became real. And it hurt. And it was also partially realizing we jumped through all of these hoops. We went through these extraordinary measures to get married, something millions of people do without giving it a second thought. And our state, the state where we lived, where we paid taxes, where we were productive members of society, was going to pretend that it never happened and erase that from John's last record. And it broke our hearts and made us angry.
Well, let me take you back two steps before we continue the story from this point and ask why it was important for you to, you've been partners for 20 years. Why was it important to be married? Why was it important that a state recognize this union?
Well, for us, we had talked about marriage many times over our 20 years together, but we decided we didn't want it to be just symbolic. We wanted to carry legal weight. We wanted to be recognized and acknowledged by our government. So when the Windsor decision came out, that gave us that opportunity. It still wasn't going to be Ohio, but it was the federal government. And honestly, it was just learning about the death certificate, this small piece of life that everyone has. Everyone has that as their last official record. And to understand in that moment what that constitutional amendment meant and how hateful and hurtful it was, it really did just broke our hearts, but I think most importantly, it made us angry. And we decided we shouldn't be told that. No other couple like us should be told that, should suffer that indignity. So we decided to file suit.
And it's interesting because you decided to file that suit. You had a lawyer who was at least working with you and made the suggestion. But there were other lawyers, particularly in the activist community, who suggested that this may not be the right time and yours may not be the right case. Am I right?
Oh, absolutely right. Within a couple weeks of filing suit, you know, national organizations reached out to Al, our attorney, and said, Al, this isn't the right case. This isn't the right time. We have a strategy that we've been working for years for marriage equality, and this just doesn't fit in. And they really pushed him to drop it. And one of the things I love most about Al always keeps his plaintiffs foremost and center. And his response to them was, this is the right time to do it because I have clients who are being harmed. This is the absolute right thing to do. And he won them over to his side.
I wonder what it was, you know, that's the moral answer. They were obviously looking at this from perhaps through a legal lens, and from their point of view, it wasn't the right time and there wasn't the right case. What was it about the case that from their point of view made it not quite right?
I think because our case was so narrowly focused, which was actually one of the reasons Al was so excited about our story, excited about meeting us, because it was so narrowly focused. It was focused on a death certificate, but he saw it as the opening act in a larger strategy going forward that could help topple that state constitutional amendment. So I think the fact that it was so narrow and it was based solely on recognition and not the right to marry, I think that's what caused a lot of those national organizations to say, we're not sure this is the right thing to do.
But in a sense, you know, getting back to his point, the fact that you have this narrow point, it's a wedge, it's a way in. Was that, in fact, what helped this case get through the courts, the fact that you're actually kind of focused on its impact on a death certificate?
Absolutely. From my opinion, that was one of the really smart things that Al did, was keep it narrow, keep it focused on one narrow issue instead of the whole enchilada. And, you know, we filed suit, and 11 days after we married, I was in federal district court, and federal judge Tim Black ruled that same day. And because it was a very narrowly focused thing, he ruled just for that. He mentioned that, you know, he wasn't ruling on the constitutionality of that state amendment, but that he had questions, he had concerns over the constitutionality of that. But then Al started a second suit, which was focused on the beginning of life and birth certificates for same-sex couples with children. So he really did. He looked at this as a process, and let's start small and build from there.
Eventually, the questions about the comparisons were made in the court cases that you were fighting to the civil rights and the fact that traditional marriage in the years of Jim Crow in the South and before that, traditional marriage meant that black people and white people were not allowed to marry. And so this idea that there was something traditional about marriage began to falter under that particular argument. Was that something that you saw going in, that this was a civil rights case with much broader implications?
Absolutely. And that was throughout the case, you know, from our first hearing through, I was in the courtroom for the birth certificate cases, appeals court, et cetera. That was always one of the arguments. You know, why are we changing the traditional meaning of marriage? It's something that we've had for millennia. Everyone knows what it means. And I always think to what Ruth Bader Ginsburg said during oral arguments when that argument came up. She said, "I'm sorry, but we have already changed the definition of marriage. Women are no longer the property of their husbands." So I expected that, and it was shot down left and right that there is no true traditional definition of marriage.
Because it
has changed.
What was it like for you, again, going through this in terms of now you're a public figure, and that means that you know, have to endure, well, I suppose you had a lot of support, and you talk about that support in your book, but also the enmity of those in the community who didn't agree with you. What was it like going through this as kind of the test case in a very public way?
Well, it was odd and surreal. But one of the things I love to tell people, because I get that question a lot, you know, you must have gotten a lot of hate mail, a lot of pushback, a lot of just terrible experiences. And it surprises people when I say in the almost 2 years from start to finish, from our case to the Supreme Court, I received 4 pieces of mail that were less than supportive. That's it. Counteracted by the hundreds and thousands of pieces of mail, cards, letters, notes, the personal interactions on the street, everywhere I went. The support was amazing, and that's what I focused on. It was clear that our story resonated with people, and it meant something really important to people across the country, and that kept me going.
Well, this conversation, of course, has been a long time coming. It's been brewing for a while. And I wonder what part the, you know, back in the 1990s, the city of Cincinnati passed a human rights ordinance that included LGBT protections. That met with a pushback, and it was eventually amended. I wonder how that, or if that, back and forth, and we think now about HB2, and again, here's protections against discrimination that get passed by a city. The state comes back and rolls back those protections against discrimination. So this back and forth seems to be continuing. I wonder if that drama in Cincinnati played any part in your decision to go forward.
Well, I will say one of the most meaningful things to me in this whole experience was to see how my city changed. You know, John and I became a couple right before that charter amendment was passed. And that charter amendment said that no laws could be passed to protect the LGBTQ community. I mean, we were called the city without pity. We were the most gay, unfriendly city in the country. But during the course of this case, you know, we sued the state of Ohio and the city of Cincinnati. And the solicitor for the city of Cincinnati stood up in court and in essence said, "Your Honor, the city of Cincinnati agrees with John and Jim. Their marriage deserves to be recognized." And it was also this wonderful occurrence in 2004. You know, in 2004, the people of Ohio voted in the constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage, but the people of Cincinnati voted to repeal that charter amendment. Mm-hmm. So for those of us in Cincinnati, it was a good year, bad year, 2004. And then just to see the city do this in our case and the incredible support that I experienced in Cincinnati and across Ohio was absolutely amazing.
So tell us about that day the ruling came down from the Supreme Court. What was that like for you?
Well, it started off on a very positive note. I arrived to the courthouse early that morning, took my place in line like I had for the other decision days as well as oral argument days. And each one of those times, a police officer would pass out tickets to the people waiting in the public line, and the tickets were always bright orange. Well, that morning, June 26th, they passed out the tickets, and I was the first one to notice that the ticket was a different color that day. It was lavender. So we all thought, well, this has to be a sign. This has to be a positive sign. So the atmosphere at the courthouse was really positive. So we took our seats in the courtroom, and the Chief Justice announced that Justice Kennedy would read the first decision, and they read our case number. And I just startled in my chair and grabbed the hands of the friend sitting on either side of me, and Justice Kennedy started to read. And initially I thought, we won. But, you know, as legal language can sometimes be confusing, then I thought, well, I'm not sure we did. I'm not sure if we did. And then it's really hit me that we did. And I burst into tears. And people around the courtroom were. And for me, other than missing John and wishing he were there to experience it, I realized one of the most amazing thoughts was that I finally felt like an equal American for the first time in my LK life.
I wonder, though, what it was like for you to have that sense of euphoria and not have John experience it with you, some moment where you had to sort of come to terms with just that.
Well, it was certainly bittersweet, but at that point, you know, John had died a year and a half previously, so I won't say I was used to John not being with me, but it certainly was something that I was getting used to, and it was what I would have loved to have him there with me to experience it, absolutely, but I didn't have that luxury. But I could be happy in the fact that we fought for each other, we fought for our marriage, and he could now truly rest in peace knowing that his death certificate would always be accurate.
Well, I understand that you own property in the Outer Banks and here in North Carolina, and I just wonder, and I know that you reacted to HB2 in the way many people did when they saw that legislation pass. Tell us about your initial reaction as a property owner in the Outer Banks.
Well, as soon as I saw on the news that Governor McCrory signed that bill, I sent an email. I own the house with John's brother. And I sent an email to him and said, I just feel like we need to sell the house. I can't support a state in any way, shape, or form that passes this type of discriminatory legislation. So we started talking about that, and I was due to go down to the house with some friends a couple weeks later. And then I realized, well, selling a house isn't always an easy thing to do, and I don't want to cancel this trip because friends were planning to go. So based on my experience there and talking with my friends there, I compiled a list of businesses that I know are either gay-owned or gay-friendly, and we made the decision we're going to go, but we will patronize only those businesses because that was a way that I felt I could take a stand, and even though the state would still get, you know, for now, property taxes and taxes on our rentals and all of that, at least I could do something, and I felt better going to North Carolina and patronizing only businesses that I knew don't discriminate.
Jim, are you registered to vote? No, you don't have to answer that.
Oh, I absolutely am.
Okay.
I won't miss it.
Your story is also, there's been an option to make a movie, right? What's that like? I mean, first doing a book and now the possibility of a movie.
It's really odd to think about my life on the big screen. You know, it's taken me a while to get used to the idea of my life in a book, but images on a big screen, it's very surreal. And you're right, we actually were lucky enough, we sold the movie rights to the unwritten book before we sold the book to the publisher. And the screenwriter's currently at work on the screenplay, and we're just waiting for him to finish that. And then at that point, Temple Hill Productions and Fox 2000 will move forward with signing on a director, things like that, so we can hopefully move into production.
Jim, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on.
Jim Obergefell is the co-author of the book Love Wins, Lovers and Lawyers Who Fought the Landmark Case for Marriage Equality. Going to be speaking at 7 o'clock Friday at Cat's Cradle in Chapel Hill. The event is a conversation with Washington Post columnist and WUNC podcaster Stephen Petro, sponsored by Flyleaf Books. We have the information at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we preview a performance that blends two compositions with readings by acclaimed novelist Richard Powers. Stay tuned.